This is The Real Dirt, brought to you by Cultivate Colorado. Cultivate your dreams, grow your legacy. CultivateColorado.com. Hey, this is The Real Dirt with Chip Baker. Today's Real Dirt is Matt Bickle with Bickle Consulting. Matt's a longtime friend of mine. He's been supplying quality medical cannabis for years to the state of Colorado and is now using his knowledge to further help people in the medical cannabis and the legal cannabis industry. Welcome, Matthew. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to kind of spill my guts here and see what we can't come up with.
Awesome. Well, this is going to be a great show. Me and Matt have been friends for a number of years. We're both met through Sound Tribe Sector 9 and immediately hit it off. Growing and smoking cannabis were topics of conversation nonstop 10 years ago. And I've watched Matt start from the basement and go to the top, literally.
Basement to the boardroom.
Yeah, somebody has coined that saying, I believe, but
I'll steal it then.
We'll just take it. Matt's considered a cannabis expert in many areas, from compliance to production, quality, techniques, technology, law, advice, encouragement. Coach Bickle, I'm wondering if we could start this interview with your idea of what the evolution of a pot grower is.
That's an easy one for me, because all I have to do is basically tell you my story. Every pot grower that I know started out a long time ago in a basement, paranoid. And I'd say the number one objective of an old school pot grower was to keep the smell down. And everything you did was based around not letting your landlord or neighbors find out that you were growing pot. And that was our main adversity for many, many years.
Afghan that don't stink.
That's right. You know, we were able to become better growers through the community we had out here in Colorado, which was, I think, a major advantage we had here in Colorado. A lot of kids were willing to share information and be a little bit more open about it than a lot of places in the rest of the country. So I think we all had a really big advantage as far as just trying to kind of combine all our knowledge together to make one better process. And that, I think, pushed us along quite a bit. As marijuana got legalized medically, that was a big, huge breakthrough for us, because I think most people figured they would retire that way eventually.
And that's 2008, 2009. Yeah, well, maybe before then, but
probably right around 2008 is when you didn't have to sell your marijuana illegally anymore. You could take it to a dispensary and immediately sell it inside the dispensary and everywhere you went. It was probably around $4,800 a pound then.
You could grow weed in your closet, your basement, your garage, your backyard, and just walk into any dispensary unregulated and sell pounds of cannabis.
100%. And those are considered the backpack days, if you were to look into the made-up hippie terminology. We had, you basically threw your weed in a backpack, went in and sold it and got cash. There was some consignment, but a lot of it was cash. People were, you know, liquidating it so quickly back then, especially the good stores, that there was no problem bringing it in. You know, you couldn't grow it fast enough.
I remember the rush of it. People would be out.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Stores would be out
empty
at the end
jars,
of the day.
One jar.
You know, people would hustle when the harvest was, and
yeah.
Oh yeah, man. I remember those early Lodo days even were like that.
Yeah, we couldn't grow it fast enough. So that started to evolve to, it got to be where vertical integration was required, which vertical integration was first introduced in the medical marijuana field. And that basically means that in order to sell marijuana, you had to grow and produce your own. Right. There's a percentage you're allowed, but you have to grow up to 70% of what you sell, which is basically the majority of all your inventory. It required, I always called it the Rockefeller rule, which they made a rule against it with John D. Rockefeller, because he had monopolies on the steel company, the railroad company that brought the ore to the steel company, the building company that built with the steel, and they fought against it. And here in Colorado, ironically, I feel like they forced it on us at first on the medical industry, which is obviously the first and only industry at first. From there, after you know, people were forced to be vertically integrated. These stores were forced to hire all these good growers that had the best backpack full of weed for the past few years. And, you know, in 2009, 2010, everybody had to kind of go find a grower. And that's where, as a grower, we had to evolve very quickly.
So people are walking into shops. They're selling weed. This is 2009, 2010.
Yep.
Right. The laws are just changing to where now it's a regulated environment to where you have to grow and sell the cannabis.
Precisely.
Right. And that's what you're talking about, vertical integration. The regulations started and changed.
Exactly.
To where, and it's changed over the years, and but it started out at like 70% or something.
Yeah,
and
right? Actually, that's never changed. The only thing that's changed is on the rec market, they got rid of vertical integration, which we'll go into later.
Right, right. And big, the medical, they still have it. Right,
yeah, it's
right,
still to this day the exact same.
Which, you know, I honestly think vertical integration was one of the best things that could have happened in Denver because it really kept the market growing. Many players got to be involved.
Exactly.
Good things for cannabis, too. Many strains came out of this. People couldn't rely on buying wholesale cannabis. They could only buy 30%. So many dispensaries have 20, 30, 40, 50, 70 different strains.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree with you. I think it's really funny how it just evolved so quickly. You know, one of the proudest moments I have of all the people in the marijuana industry in Colorado, at least, is that we just kept jumping through hoops. And where everyone just thought, you know, they could regulate us out of this industry or find a way, you know, too many hoops for us to jump through. Everyone just kept, you know, like 70-30, done. And the exact explanation of 70-30 for everyone listening is that you have to produce 70% of what you sell in-house, and you're allowed to purchase wholesale 30% of what you sell. And to come up with that number, it's in a year's time. It's a difficult number because, as you can imagine, you sell so much product at, you know, different speeds and different rates. It's hard to actually come up with that number. So you have basically till the very end of the year, and then you have to start getting your numbers and seeing where you're at in your ratios and try and get that caught up to 70 and 30. And the majority of people have a problem with purchasing more than 30% wholesale because they can't produce enough because they sell so much. And so they have a major problem at the end of the year catching up with the amount of wholesale they purchased, and they just have to produce more of their own. So getting back to the evolution of a pot grower.
Evolution of the pot grower, I know. So vertical integration. We were just speaking of that. You know, the interesting thing about vertical integration is how much money it made for people.
Yeah.
Right.
The average Joe.
Yeah, absolutely. So it allowed people to grow 70% of their product, and then they're selling it in-house at $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $10,000 a pound at the time. Right, up to $25 a gram, $30 a gram.
Absolutely.
Right.
I remember it being $9,000 a pound sold retail, if done right.
Yeah, right.
And the
right,
profit
right.
margin was at 90% if you were vertically integrated 100%.
Right, right. Yeah, just an incredible profit, an incredible quick turn. And many people had problems meeting their sales demands on a monthly basis. They oversold every single month.
Yeah.
Right. And there was regulations issues with that because many people continue to buy on the wholesale market, right? Even though they were producing, say, 70%, 100 pounds. Say they were producing 70 pounds a month and buying 30 pounds a month, but they were selling 200 pounds a month, right? Yeah, no doubt. And in the early days, there wasn't much regulation for that either. But no. Wholesale prices back then were $4,000+ a pound still, too.
Absolutely.
Right. So still great money. Buy it for $4, you're selling it for $9.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that went on for a while until everyone, you know, that's basically where we all got jobs. The cream got to rise to the top. All the best basement growers got to get a job in a dispensary. Everybody had an opportunity. A lot of people failed. A lot of people succeeded. That was basically how it kind of stayed until January 2012 when marijuana got legalized on the recreational side. And that's when the lid blew off the thing, and that's when everything changed.
Right. Now, when did you get a job working for a dispensary?
Well, I worked with Colorado Alternative Medicine, building out their grow and helping them grow before you had to have a badge, before there was any
regulations.
Right. Then I kind of separated ways with them and started working at Loda Wellness Center in 2010. My job interview was literally bringing jars of weed down and showing the quality of the flower, and that was all it took. you know, it was, we had to bring our own equipment in, which was pretty fun.
So you walked into this dispensary, you noticed they had shitty weed.
Yep.
They're like, their weed was bad.
Yep.
And you approached the owner, pulled out a sack of better weeds, like, look, this is what I could do for you.
Absolutely. Nah. Got the job on the spot.
Got the job on the spot.
Yep.
Awesome. When did you start working after that?
Yeah, the next day, you know, the very next day, we did a walkthrough of the flower room, and they had every bug and mold problem there was, and I was a buddy of a buddy getting to grow the weed there that literally tried to watch the show Weeds and kind of YouTube how to grow marijuana and was absolutely burying the business.
Right. There's so many people out there like that.
Yeah. It's more common than you think. So
no, it's absolutely common. I have this phrase that everyone who's ever smoked a joint thinks they can make $1 million with cannabis somehow.
That's probably
like,
about
they're like, oh man, we could grow $1 million of this shit. You know, if I could get enough of this, I could make $1 million.
Absolutely. And now they're all doing it. Or trying.
Trying to. It's changed a little bit, man. It's definitely not as lucrative for people. The regulations have come in. So it's 2012.
It's about the same time that rec went legal is when we really got our regulations hammered down on us as far as enforcement. The laws have been written for a long time, but as a grower, you were able to kind of just, you know, if you didn't intentionally break the law, there was really no problems in being a grower. And that's when things really started to change around 2012. People had to be able to grow it compliantly. And at first that just meant tagging your plants, keeping it in a metric system, which, you know, showed the seed to sale tracking of the plant. And for an old crusty grower, that's definitely something, you know, tough to get used to because you're so used to not having to do anything as far as, you know, you don't have to answer to anyone. And now all of a sudden you have to grow your pot and answer to someone. And that definitely started to also kind of make the cream rise to the top again. Could you grow a good pot? Could you do it within the laws?
Right. You know, one thing people don't realize that aren't associated with cannabis is that people have been growing weed indoors and outdoors in their backyards and in fields, you know, for years. The indoor metal halide light became popular for growing weed in 1980.
Yeah.
Right. So literally people came out of their closets to go to work that may have never even had a job.
Yeah.
And previously they were making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 out of their closets and not working, right? Yeah. 15 minutes a day, maybe 10 minutes a day.
No taxes.
Vacations, no taxes. Now they're asked to work in a dispensary, or now they come to the dispensary environment.
Absolutely.
Right, right. And that's what you're speaking of, like the hard transition.
Totally.
Right.
And the funny thing is like, they almost gave us enough rope to hang ourselves because they didn't regulate it at first. And all these growers came in and kind of just had free reign and were just doing whatever they wanted.
Right, right.
And then they enforced the laws. And so it really kind of got you fast.
Totally put the brakes on it.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah, man. I mean, you know, it was a slow roll on the enforcement. And that's the interesting thing about legal cannabis in California, Colorado, Oregon, Washington, all the other states that are legalizing or have legalized it in some manner. Is that it's not just day one where it's legal, right? They like on January 1st, 2014, they started selling cannabis in Colorado legally, recreationally. I was like number 46 in your store, Lodo Wellness.
Yeah.
Right. And they passed the law in 2012.
Yeah.
So it took 2 years after they passed the law before they were able to legalize it.
Crazy.
Before they were able to sell it. Right. And like even on that first day, July 1st, remember everyone sold out of weed.
Yeah.
And some people sold as much weed in one day as they did in a month.
January 1st. Yeah.
On January 1st.
Absolutely.
And then it was like hard to get.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Prices rose. Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Like I remember it at your shop.
They had to.
Your shop's premium shop, small shop, craft cannabis. And you guys only grow top notch buds, Lodo Wellness and plug. And man, it was like $30 a gram for OG Kushin there.
Yeah, and with a 2 gram limit, remember?
And a 2 gram limit.
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
Absolutely. And the funny part about that is on December 31st of 2013, we had no clue. You know, we didn't know if there was going to be 50 people in front of the store the next day or one, or if it was going to be the same as the day before. We had no idea. And it just ran over us like a freight train. I mean, there was, I think, you know, I think the first day we saw 3,500 people through the store.
All right.
And the most people we'd seen through the store prior to that was like maybe 110. Wow. So things changed quick.
Oh, yeah. There were lines out everybody's door. We also went to, on January 1st, 2014, we stood in line at 7 a.m. at your shop at Lodo. And then we went over to our other friends, Greg Gamut and Justin Jones facility, Dank.
Yep.
Had like 300 plus people in line.
I believe, right? And you have to fact check me on this, but I believe it was only like 13 stores that were ready to go that day.
Hardly any. Maybe it was 13. It was definitely a small amount, though. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So we're up 2014 in your evolution.
Yep.
Right.
This is when it gets crazy again as a grower. Right about end of 2014 is when the Colorado Department of Agriculture, the Colorado Fire Department, the Denver Fire Department especially, and the Environmental Protection Agency all kind of got together with the Marijuana Enforcement Division and started to regulate pesticides, which was a huge problem we had here that needed to happen, or needed to be fixed, I should say. There was a lot of growers who got really comfortable using illegal pesticides that were not approved here, and they were not being used responsibly. And you know, ultimately, the consumer was who was going to suffer from that. And there was a huge crackdown. And I would say that it would be comparable to taking Tylenol away from doctors is how the industry had to react as a grower.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most growers didn't know anything else but what was in the medicine cabinet, and it had worked for years, and it really turned things upside down.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. The regulation on the pesticides are something that absolutely need to happen, but it really did open up this can of worms on labeling issues.
And, oh, man.
You know, because that's what it is. It's a label issue about the pesticides, and not really if it's healthy for me or you.
Yep.
Because it might be something that can be sprayed on grapes or tomatoes or tobacco.
Stuff that is.
That is. And in the grocery store, if you're getting non-organic food or food that has pesticides sprayed on it, you're getting those same chemicals that are not regulated for cannabis in Colorado or Washington.
Yes.
Right? And it's a labeling issue.
So what that basically is the FDA has not approved marijuana because it's federally illegal. So there is not an FDA single product that can be labeled FDA approved. All products sold in America, pesticides, have to be FDA approved. And no company is allowed to put marijuana on it because it's not federally recognized. So what it ends up doing is it ties the hands of the people who could test it, could show that it's legal to use on marijuana, and that it's totally safe. There's, you know, every beer that's drank in America has had Eagle 20 sprayed on it, which is to keep powdery mildew off it. And that's kind of like the
black plague
of, you know, marijuana. If you get caught using that, it's the worst thing you can get caught with.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, it has been difficult for people. Now the only products that they can use are the ones that are labeled for general agricultural use, general garden use.
Yes.
Which means mostly it's organic product,
mm-hmm.
right? Mostly it's soaps, botanical extracts, neem oil extracts, azadirachtin.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Potassium salts.
Absolutely.
Which is great for the industry to some degree.
Yeah.
Right, because there's less stuff on it, but there's also some other problems that are developing over this, right?
Absolutely, powdery mildew issues, bug issues.
People would rather let the bugs be on the cannabis than just spray it. Which there's definitely an argument on that, but just the quality of cannabis starts to degrade.
Absolutely,
right. And so we've seen spider mites running all over the plants
industry wide.
Right, absolutely. Wow, quality has gone down since 2010. You think?
I think so, and it's probably a safer product to smoke, at least without knowing any better. If every single batch of marijuana was tested, I think we'd find out that when responsibly used, some of these pesticides would be great for the industry and for the entire you know,
right,
the consumer.
Absolutely, with proper integrated pest management techniques.
Yes. Right. I mean, as far as like a nursery style where you, you know, all your starters get the illegal pesticides, or not illegal, but just harsh pesticides on them. And then they
chemical,
get sold
synthetic.
To a grower who can then, you know, who's not allowed to use them. And you could go the entire life cycle of the plant. So by the time you were to test it, the final product, the flower, there's absolutely none of the chemical in it. Then we've done ourselves a great favor, because another problem with the organic sprays is not enough people know how to use them. They're being overused and people are overspraying their plants.
Right.
And that's where the quality is really starting to suffer.
Right.
You're just burning the hell out of your plants with all these sprays.
There's so much misinformation on pesticide use, because when people read the back of the bottle, or consultants look at it, or pesticide people look at it, they have no history with cannabis.
Yep.
So what we're smoking is the cannabis flower. It's the dried cannabis flower. And I know I have my own opinion, but I believe that we shouldn't be spraying anything on the flower.
I agree.
And you should have all your shit together before you flip the lights, before you flower it.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't spray anything else. Unfortunately, with the organic pesticides, people don't have a proper integrated pest management system, and they're spraying oil extracts all the way to the finished product, right?
And now the state does microbial testing, and it's pretty heavy duty as far as it can pick up almost anything. And most people are finding that molds and yeast are where they're failing with their product. And it's almost becoming an epidemic now, because you have to pay to grow it, to get it all the way harvested, trimmed, and tested before you can find out. And it's store ready in a jar at that point. And that's when you get it tested and find out if it's able to sell or not. Now you can still get it made into concentrates, and because it is able to kill, you know, certain processes for making concentrates can kill the mold in the marijuana, and you can still get the good stuff out of it. But as far as, you know, you wouldn't ever spend that much money to produce it the way you did until you, you know, if you were knowing that 25% of it was going to fail, you would just be trying to not do that.
No doubt. Do you think that Bacillus compost tea, that's affecting mold and yeast counts?
I think if anything, that's maybe helping. Like, only because the plant is a little bit more resilient and a little bit
and
more.
And it's eating the mold.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know.
And just spraying shit on your flowers, literally, because that's compost tea.
Yeah.
While you're, it just hurts me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I like go in dispensaries for my market research, and you know, buy cannabis there, and you know, I look at it, and I can almost look at it and tell if it's had any type of liquid sprayed on it during the course of its flowering lifetime, because the crystals get washed
off.
It has a different color
even
to
burnt.
It, then. Even burnt. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man, it's a funny thing. I really think that, you know, again, if we were able to use some of these banned products in a responsible way, we wouldn't have to spray much at all.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I know there's this whole federal state regulation issues with cannabis, and this is one direct cause of this problem.
Yes.
Or effect of this problem is there's federal laws that say that cannabis is legal and is a Schedule I drug. And it keeps cannabis from being used responsibly or grown responsibly in this manner, because there's no company that can state on their label that you can use this for cannabis.
Yep.
Right. You can use this for hemp. You can use this for ganja.
Precisely.
Nobody says that. Nobody can say that.
Yep. Their hands are tied.
Nobody's going to be able to say it. Right.
Yep.
Until the schedule changes.
Totally.
Right.
And I think that we can thank the large alcohol companies, tobacco companies, pharmaceutical companies for pushing really hard against us to not allow it to be, you know, the schedule to be changed or marijuana to be legalized, because our drug's so much better than theirs.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, you know, they're gonna be the first people to really hop in it as soon as it's legal, though.
They're trying to already.
You know, they are hopping into it on the side, around the back door. But it's difficult for large companies to invest in cannabis legally. It's not so difficult if you're within the state and you're, you know, a local and within that state to invest cannabis dollars. There's lots of venture capitalists. There's lots of private equity. There's even banks that'll loan people money. There's equipment financer people.
And even if they're not investing, they're positioning.
They're positioning. That's absolutely true. All right. Well, hey, let's take a break there. This is Real Dirt with Chip Baker and Matt Bickle. We're talking about evolution of a pot grower with Matt Bickle here on Real Dirt with Chip Baker. Matt, you're not so much a pot grower anymore, though, are you?
No, actually, I don't get to grow a whole lot of pot anymore.
And that is the evolution.
Yes, sir, it is.
Right. So tell me about Matt Bickle Consulting.
So during this whole evolution, I've always been dumb enough or smart enough to go listen to everyone, to pay attention to what everyone's doing, and to try and take best techniques from all my different friends, all the different growers I've met, and try and do what makes sense to my logical brain. And through that and a lot of trial and error, I was able to, you know, come up with some pretty good techniques that worked well in Colorado and with my strains in the system that, you know, I'm comfortable and used to. And I found myself helping a whole lot of other friends do the same thing and with a little bit of success. So I knew there was something there. And I'm good friends with Mason Trevert, who is one of the main marijuana policy project guys.
I'm trying to get Mason on the show right now.
Oh, awesome. I met him in front of my grocery store getting signatures for legalization in like 2008 when we were trying to get it on the Denver ballot. And I've always been a huge fan of his. He's one of the coolest guys I've ever met and is also who we can probably thank along with a few other cool people for legalizing marijuana here in Colorado. So as things become legal, as rec becomes legal, as the evolution kind of grows, I start to see that there's a huge void for quality marijuana in the industry and also a huge opportunity to kind of evolve. And so I stuck my nose out to Mason and asked him if he could point me in the right direction as far as getting a consulting company going. And he directed me to the folks at Vicente Cederberg, who is anyone in the marijuana industry in Colorado is very familiar with these guys.
In the country, honestly.
Yeah.
Right.
They're the
world, really.
They're the... I say between Brian Vicente, Christian Cederberg, and Mason Trevert and Steve Fox, that's like the Moses and Jesus of marijuana. They kind of walked us into the promised land, those four guys. And Brian and Christian are not only awesome lawyers, but amazing people, incredible activists. Same with Mason and Steve. And those guys formed a pretty strong team that pulled off legalization here in Colorado, Amendment 64. Brian was the author of Amendment 64. Christian was the head of the task force that implemented all the laws. And these guys just really, you know, took it upon themselves and put it on their shoulders to legalize pot for us. Whenever I got, you know, the idea to start consulting, my first thought was to reach out to these guys in Mason. I met with them all. And we were able to kind of put something together that made sense that I could start working with them before I started doing consulting. A big problem in the industry is compliance and lack of knowledge of compliance. So I went to work for those guys for 6 months as kind of a intern education in compliance with a bunch of lawyers and found out how to, you know, basically teach people how to do it, grow really good pot without breaking the law. And so that was an amazing opportunity for me and an amazing.
Oh, you went from flip flops to three piece suit. Yeah. I remember that.
Yes, sir. Right? I did. yeah. Thank God I don't have to wear those suits.
You're back
anymore.
To flip flops
yeah,
now, right?
Yeah. Right. Presently. So, working with those guys was a huge eye opening experience as to just, you know, how many more layers there are to this industry than just growing a plant and sticking it on a shelf. You know, you talk about in your blogs, the grower, the dealer, and the smoker, and this was truly the full circle. I got to see the entire, you know, process of marijuana from a regulatory standpoint all the way through, you know, the entire sale of it and the compliance that goes involved with that. A big way I like to explain it that someone taught me was that the Colorado marijuana industry is regulated as if the wine industry were to be regulated by them making you count the grapes versus the bottles you sell. So we don't get to just package all the marijuana up and put it in a bag and count how many bags we sold. We have to count every single piece of marijuana as it's grown, as it's processed, and as it's sold. This makes it a much more tricky place to actually be a good grower and also be a compliant grower.
Yeah, there's no hiding behind those numbers. So when you harvest cannabis here, you have to weigh it right when you cut it.
The entire plant.
The entire plant. And yep. The entire plant. And then it's labeled.
Yes.
And you dry it.
Yep.
And when it's dried, it's trimmed. And then you have to weigh the leaf, the stem,
and
the bud.
And the waste.
And the waste. Whatever. Yep. But what's the waste?
The waste would be any big leaves you pulled off, all the extra stem. There's some people that because there's not a true definition of the law, I've seen people weigh their cocoa balls, their root balls, whatever the medium they're in. I've seen, you know, all kinds of different and techniques. And that's the funny thing is the state has never sent someone out and said, this is how you do it. So a guy like me that gets to go into a whole lot of grows all the time is a riot to see what people have come up with as their idea of compliance, their idea of regulation, because people are so excited to be a part of the industry that they don't want to break the law. They want to follow it to the T or even further. And so their interpretation of what they read or whatever attorney they have or, you know, however they come to these conclusions is absolutely a riot. I've seen, you know, people just doing the craziest stuff, weighing the, you know, trying to weigh the moisture in the air to see if they had to account for that as a plant loses weight as it dries, and just absolutely insane, idiotic things.
So you've gone to dozens or hundreds of grow rooms through this Bickle Consulting.
Yes.
Right.
I wouldn't say hundreds, but maybe 100.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of hard to keep track. Well, man, when you first, in the early days with the compliance issues, like I remember you were just like 3-4 a day.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. And that was a lot to do with the pesticide crisis. I started working with Ascente Cedarburg right at the same time as the pesticide crisis. So a lot of clients were, when I say pesticide crisis, I mean a lot of people were starting to get, they knew they were incompliant and didn't have a way to stop mold and bugs without breaking the law. So a lot of people reached out to them and they were able to utilize me for that. And I'd say that was what really springboarded things, and that's why I did so many volume of people for such a long time.
Right. I mean, you've helped dozens of people in compliance with cannabis cultivation. You know, you're kind of like a priest to some degree. But can you say give me some stories? You got a strange story for me?
Strange story.
You know, what's the oddest thing? What's the most interesting thing? What's the craziest thing you've seen at one of these grow rooms?
Well, one of the craziest things I've seen is last year, a client of mine down in Southern Colorado decided to grow 8,000 plants on 9 acres, which was all outdoor, all organic, all from seed. And the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life was the attempt at the very bold attempt at trying to do that with a very small staff and not the best equipment, I guess.
Going for it.
Yeah, just head over heels went for it. It didn't go so good, I'll say that, but it was one of the most interesting educational experiences of my life.
Right.
The adversity of you know, true farming versus growing pot and how spoiled you are inside a greenhouse, inside a you know, warehouse right. where you've got environmental control. Mother Nature is not whipping your ass on a daily basis on your plants and you, you know, the physical toll it takes on your body. That's definitely one of the more, you know, mind-blowing experiences I've had as a grower. And just driving up on 8,000 plants is pretty cool, though.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I've been selling cannabis farmers equipment for 15 years. I've seen this type of thing happen over and over again. People like to bite off more than they can chew. Yeah. We do it when we go to a buffet. I've been to a buffet with you. Right.
True.
And we like to bite off more than we can chew.
Yeah.
Right. The enthusiasm of I'm going to crush it. I'm going to blow it out.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and then there's a fine line between trying to grow money and grow marijuana.
Right.
And I know that's one of the points we had talked about right. going over today.
Growing money. Are you growing money or are you growing weed?
I found that, you know, I'd say if you wanted to look at the industry as a whole, the first 25% of the lifespan of the industry was all basically people that wanted to grow marijuana, that wanted to grow good weed. Money was a bonus. They knew they were going to get it. But you had to stick your neck out there at the beginning.
Right, because you wanted it. You had to want
and
it.
And you very well could have gone to jail as far as we knew.
Right,
there
forever.
Were still people getting raided in California, dispensaries right. all the time. We had no idea the federal presence that we were going to receive here or lack of, which is what we did receive, due to the fact that we were able to regulate it a little bit faster than California. But without not knowing that, everyone who was working in the industry for the first 4 or 5 years was sticking their neck out there, gambling.
Oh, yeah.
All the people that are invested now were calling us idiots back then. It was definitely, you know, only growing weed.
Right. Yeah. You know, California's had such a long history of cannabis cultivation and legal enforcement over it.
Yep.
And Colorado never really got that.
Because we wrote the laws
right.
so much faster.
You wrote the laws better even to some degree. And, well, California's just dealing with their laws right now. But,
yeah.
you know, I love California. Lived there 15 years. Huge state. Great state. Still have a home there. Love the place.
Absolutely.
It's got its fair share of problems with any law or commerce.
Yeah. We're strictly right. speaking government here.
We're just strictly speaking government yeah. here. So
we can beat up.
If you're out there and you think I'm Cali hating, I ain't.
Absolutely not.
Matter of fact, you should send me an ounce of dank California weed anytime you want. But
that's awesome.
But Colorado made it happen because they were able to, through a legislative process, legalize the use of medical cannabis and put in regulations to control it.
Absolutely.
No one else had done that before.
Yes.
Right. And that's what really made it successful here.
Yeah. And the right. funny thing is, you know, something we were really interested in talking about too was the difference between regulation and the illusion of regulation, which
I think the packaging
kind of, you know, as far as wanting to bring the real dirt to everybody listening, I really would say that this is something we'd have to dive into because we are regulated. We have a ton of rules. We do a really good job of creating the illusion that we're following those rules to a T. And in saying that, I would tell you that no one who breaks the law intentionally is getting away with it. Eventually, those people are getting caught.
Right. All the outlaws and criminals have been getting caught, for sure.
Yes, sir. But the difference is that there's 560 laws that are impossible to follow if you're not an expert in the laws. And there's always right. a chance that you can be breaking two or three of those at any time and be completely clueless.
An example of this would be harvesting cannabis. Explain how you could break the law when you harvest cannabis.
So you're harvesting cannabis. Anyone who's ever been a part of a marijuana harvest would know that as you're taking the plant out of the table, out of the room, and over to trim it, buds are going to fall on the floor. It's just inevitable. You know, a piece gets caught in the doorway, a piece is still hung up on the trellis and it gets ripped off. Every plant is supposed to be weighed whole with every single piece of the plant together. So when a bud falls off and you don't know what bud it is, you know, now you have to either throw it away or try and identify it and add it to a batch. It becomes this huge issue, whereas you should be able to throw it into the miscellaneous pile like everyone else has that's right. ever grown marijuana that's not regulated and be able to just, you know, regard it as some of the floor buds. But now in a compliant grow, you have like this huge problem where you don't know where this bud came from. So to follow the law, you have to grind it up, integrate it with 50% non-marijuana plant matter, make it unrecognizable and unusable, and throw it away and tag it and document it. All this over a bud that hit the floor. You know, it's just one of those situations where at any given day, you know, any trimmer that's going to really know that process that I just told you is shouldn't be a trimmer. You know,
they should be
working as a compliance officer, because I certainly didn't know it. And so every day I ever harvested growing pot, I was constantly, you know, dropping buds, picking them up, tossing them in with, you know, the closest bin. And every time I did it, I was breaking the law.
Right, right. And until you figured out how not to do that. And
precisely.
And I know you have a fairly specific technique for harvesting and keeping track of compliant cannabis.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's a proper phraseology, but we'll just go with it. It's very specific. It's not just cutting it all down, throwing it into a pile, hanging it on a, you know, a hanger.
Exactly.
Right. You have to take care, do it in a specific manner.
Yeah, there's documents. Right? We produce documents to make it easier.
So, you know, we should really start at the beginning here. We've kind of like been all over the place, but we're talking about the regulation. Are other people out there, they're new to cannabis, they don't know anything about buying or selling it, they just think they can go buy a joint. They just think weed's legal now, and they buy a joint. But let's talk about what regulation really is.
Regulation is, it's a big, huge net that the government has cast out to catch every dollar they possibly can from this industry, because it's a very lucrative and promising industry.
Right. Bureaucracy.
Absolutely. It's also, regulation is a way to just, you know, obviously police the industry, to not let it get out of control. It was the only way that...
To keep the criminal and outlaw element out of the business, for sure. You have to have regulations.
Yes, sir. And also, I think that with, you know, the entire rest of the world putting Colorado under the microscope, being the first regulated marijuana industry with a huge market, and you know, everyone kind of wanted to hone in on us, I feel like they, in writing the laws, overregulated them, but then also didn't really have an understanding of how to enforce the same laws they wrote, being right. The state of Colorado.
They just sounded like a good idea on paper.
Yeah.
Right.
They sound amazing. But to go live those rules, those 550 rules on a daily basis, to try and follow them, to try and do it correctly, is incredibly difficult. And everyone does it. And they also wrote an entire new terminology for us. Metric program, which is the seed to sale tracking program that's state required, is, you know, is an entire industry of terminology that everyone had to learn. And it'd be kind of like if, you know, someone said, gave you a board game and showed you the rules to the board game and said, all right, go do this for millions of dollars. Like, it's, you know, just completely out of left field, this tracking program that no one knows how to really use. And everyone's just kind of becoming experts in the rule book. And I know people that are making a crazy living just by being experts in the rules, you know?
Right. Absolutely. So many areas, so many ancillary businesses have developed with legal cannabis, and compliance officers, so to speak, compliance consultants.
Yep.
That's one of the things you do, is you consult people on compliance. You walk into their grow room and you say, hey, this is how you're out of regulation. This is how you get into regulation.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, I would defer any of the big stuff to the compliance department of Vicente Cedarburg, just because they have their finger on the pulse of the rules a little bit more than I do. But sure. A bonus of having me around is I can walk through as a former employee of theirs and be like, hey, you know that that's missing a tag and it's over 8 inches taller and 8 inches wide, you can get your place shut down. So I can offer little bits of advice here and there, but you know, between the two of us, we can sew you up solid as far as compliance goes.
All right. So, hey, let's do this cool little exercise. This will be great. In a short phraseology, let's go through it from start to finish of growing a plant.
Okay.
Right. Try to, like, we'll just keep it to like small compliance like sentences. Let's keep this in compliance.
Okay.
All right. Where do we start?
So where you start is,
okay, let's back it up. We've already have a compliant and legal grow room.
Okay. So we're standing in a compliant and legal grow room, and we're going to go cut a clone off of a mother that is tagged and put in metric as either a medical or a recreational plant. There's no difference.
Metric is the state's
tracking system.
Tracking system that tracks the cannabis seed to sale, clone to sale.
Absolutely. Right. So in this metric program, the program knows what room, you have to have every room labeled or numbered, and it knows what room the mother plant is in, and it knows that the plant is there. It knows the number on the plant, and it knows whether it's recreational or medical. It's only difference RFID being
tag.
Yes, sir. And the only difference is the color of the tag is makes it medical or recreational.
So that's the only difference for between medical and recreational in the start, in the grow room.
Yes.
Is the color of the tag.
Absolutely. That's the on exact the same plants. Yeah.
On the clone. On so the clone. You're saying that you got have sour diesel plants, you take 50 clones and you put a recreational tag on it, and 50 clones and you can put a medical tag on it?
Well, you have to cut 50 clones from the medical sour diesel mom, or you have to cut 50 clones from the recreational sour diesel mom. You have to have a match of each mom, one of each, sure. But they're identical plants. They're identical the same
plants.
DNA.
Same plants.
Okay. Yeah. So you cut a clone from this mom, and you have to tell Metric. Metric, we're going to talk a lot about here throughout this process because it's basically you, big brother looking over your shoulder. So you tell Metric that you cut 50 immature sour diesel clones of recreational, and you put them in as immature. Now, they were wise enough to understand that there's an attrition rate and that all 50 clones might not root, especially with the growers I've seen out there. We might get five to root. But hopefully you get 45 to 50 of your clones to root. At that point, they become immature plants. So when they have roots, they still don't need a tag. They're just basically considered a clone at that point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you take that plant and you pot it. And once
do they call them cuttings or clones in the law?
Clones.
Okay,
clones. Yeah, and they're in the clone stage. Mm-hmm. Once they're rooted, then they're accounted for as a real plant, but they don't need a tag until they're 8 inches tall or 8 inches wide. So you basically take a plant, it's rooted, you pot it, whatever your medium is, it grows to 8 inches tall or 8 inches wide, it's still in the metric as a immature plant or a clone. And then once it's 8 inches tall or 8 inches wide, there has to be a tag associated with it and it has to be attached to the plant. So you can't take it off right. The plant.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically gets you into the vegetative state of the plant. Now you, at that point, will actually switch it to vegetative in the program on the computer.
Okay. And register the plant.
Yeah. Well, it's once you associate a tag with it, the tags are registered when they send them to you. So as soon as you associate a tag with the plant, it's already got an RFID tag that the state knows it sent you and is already like in the system. They pre-put them in the system for you. It's pretty cool.
Right.
So basically, if you go to type in the serial number of a plant tag that isn't there, it won't even show up in the computer because the state has to issue you the tags that have the serial numbers on them already.
Right.
That's a little complicated, but that's just because we're stoned, probably.
No. You did that great, man. That's great. I'm following you. I'm learning some stuff here. So now we've entered the vegetative program on the software.
Yep. And you will, at that point, have to designate what room it's in again. So it's probably going to go from maybe a clone room to a veg room. You have those rooms labeled, pre-labeled in your program. And so you just say it went from the clone room to the veg room. While it's in the veg room and it's got a tag on it, it's completely compliant and ready to go as far as the state's eyes. Besides, when you switch it into flower, you need to tell the state that it goes from the veg room to the flower room. And then it stays in the flower room until harvest, which is when it starts to get a little more complicated. And upon harvest time, you go in, you cut down the plant, and you weigh the entire plant whole. Then you go into Metric and you tell the plant its entire wet weight. The part that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me is that you can wet trim or dry trim and input the same amount of information, but you still have to weigh the plant wet. And so there's a huge discrepancy if you were going to dry trim your marijuana because you weigh it as a whole while it's wet. And then when it's completely dry, you go to trim it and there's like your stems are completely hollowed out. Everything's completely dry and you have absolutely no moisture weight in it. So there's like this major discrepancy. You can also weigh it wet and whole. And still, it's just basically too kind of a gap in the system. And I guess that's just my own problem I have with it that I shouldn't go too far into.
All right, let's keep going.
Awesome. So you weigh the plant whole, record that weight, then you trim it, and you have to separate all your non-usable leaf, which is waste, big leaves, all your usable sugar leaf, which is trim, all your stems, and all your flower. You take that, all those pieces, and you don't have to weigh any of that once you've weighed the plant wet whole until it's dry. So then you hang it all up on hangers, dry it all the way you would normally dry your marijuana. And then when the marijuana is dry, you take the flower off the stem and you weigh just the buds. That goes into a package as a flower package. And, you know, you would fill up a jar, designate the 97 grams you got off the one plant of sour diesel, and tell the state that you have a package that's 97 grams, and it will receive a package tag at this point. So the tag that was on the plant for the entire life of it is now trash and discarded, and there's a package tag on the jar of marijuana where all the dry product goes. That's all the good stuff. Then anything else you're going to use for concentrates, which would be either sugar leaf or non-sugar for some people, but mostly sugar for people, you bag that sugar leaf up, and then that gets another package tag as trim. Then all the rest is weighed and regarded as waste. Then you have to take all that waste, and I spoke about this a minute ago, but this is one of the crazy fun laws of Colorado marijuana industry, is we have to then take the waste and grind it all up to where it's unusable and unrecognizable. Those are the two terms of the law that are very important to them.
Okay, so you've got some waste product.
Yep, stems and big leaf.
You grind it up, and what do you mix it with?
So there's actually a list in the law of the things you're allowed to use. The majority of people grow in cocoa, so it makes very easy sense just to use your cocoa root balls as your mixer, but it has to be 51% non-marijuana product, 49% marijuana product. It's very specific in the law. So you have to use more than half of non-marijuana product and co-mingle it to where you couldn't tell what it was, unusable, unrecognizable. You couldn't say that's a pot leaf and be able to use it. So most people have gas mulchers, send all their stems through the gas mulcher, send all their leaf through the gas mulcher, which should be enough to throw it away right there, in my opinion. Then you have to mulch up all your root balls. Then you have to take a shovel and mix the two together, you know, until you have 51% non-marijuana product. Then you have to shovel that shit into a dumpster, and then that dumpster has to be locked and secured in a fenced-in area with cameras on it.
And the dumpster, it just goes to the garbage at that point.
Yeah,
because totally. It's landfill.
Yeah, most people are hopefully composting at this point. It's an option that you are allowed to use, and you know, don't have to, unfortunately. But most of the clients I work with use a compost company. There's actually some companies that will come right to your front door and pick it up and do that entire process I just told you for a very hefty fee.
Right. Wow. So that's the life of a tag plant. So I got a couple questions here. You have some clones that you've tagged. You got some plants that are in the vegetative state that you've tagged. You've got plants in the grow room that are flowering that you've tagged.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So inspector comes in, right? How do they count all the plants and make sure you have your number of plants that you're supposed to have in there? How do they keep track of it?
They're supposed to have an RFID tag reader that they could walk into the room, shoot a gun, and it'll bring up every plant in the room. They didn't account for the fact that RFID tag readers didn't work when there was ballast in the room.
Oh, geez.
And every grow room I've ever been to has some ballast in it.
Right, electronic interference.
Unfortunately, though, the first phase of the process was a failure for those guys. They do, though, have Metric, which is the program we keep speaking about.
So it's all database entry.
Yep. And right. So you can actually, you know, you have to input every single plant into it until right. It designates the room.
And you just scan it with a scanner.
Yep. One at a time.
One at a time.
Yeah. And those seem to work fine. The RFID, so a scanner being a barcode scanner, and there's a barcode on every plant versus an RFID reader, which is the little electronic tag that's inside of the tag or electronic chip that's inside of the tag that was unable to work with ballast.
So this is the seed to sale that everybody talks about.
Yep.
That's what you just spoke of. Right?
That's seed to store and store to stale, right, okay. Is just a little bit more that I won't claim to be an expert in, but is a very complicated part of the Metric program. It starts to get really, really tough to kind of keep tabs on something that is fluctuating in weight in a really dry atmosphere. Being Colorado, you know, no humidity, and as you open the jars and sell the pot, you know, you lose moisture weight, and they're trying to regulate it all the way down to the single grape, like we talked about. So unfortunately, right. You know, it starts to make a lot of discrepancies.
If you have one complaint about the system that would make it better, do you have just one? Is there one?
I would say, well, I've already said it, is they're trying to regulate it, like making us count the grapes in the wine industry. And if they would just let us sell, you know, regulate it like wine, whereas how many bottles did you sell? How many ounces? How many pounds? Right. Versus, you know,
how many grams?
How many grams did you grow? Because they're so worried about the diversion of marijuana, where in fact, no one would be stupid enough to want to sell it illegally, in my opinion, because this is such a beautiful thing to be a part of. Why would you screw that up, you know?
Right, right. Is it hard to enter the marketplace to be in the illegal cannabis grower?
To be a grower, yes, absolutely.
To sell it.
Yeah, there's a way in to be a part of the industry always. You can always get a job as a trimmer. If you're the best trimmer there, you can get a job as a grower. If you're the best grower there, you can get the head grower job. You can evolve yourself, but it's right. It's definitely tough to get.
But they just won't let anybody in as you have to have some type of run a background check on you, right, yeah. In order to become a badged employee in the cannabis industry.
That's a major hoop.
Right. Right, major deal right there.
But yep.
I do know that 15,000 or 16,000 people had badges.
Yeah.
As of January 1st, 2016,
which is amazing.
Right? Yeah, yeah, 16, yeah.
16,000 jobs.
Hey, man, it was up from like 7,000 the previous year.
Yep.
Right, because of recreational cannabis increased that many more jobs.
Families
in the area.
Are eating.
So many of them is Denver. Like, we've seen the growth here.
Oh my gosh.
The growth is like the parking's a little difficult now. It's hard to get houses. Everyone who seems to be moving to Denver, one of the reasons is legal cannabis.
Absolutely.
Right? It's like you could work at an insurance company or a bank anywhere in the country, and they have an office here. You just think, wow.
Yeah.
Maybe I should move to Denver. Maybe I should move to Colorado.
I like to call it trickle-up economics.
Trickle-up. It used to be inexpensive here, but it's becoming to be an expensive city.
Yeah.
Right.
Great place to live, though, man.
Oh, I love it here, man. Mile High City.
Coolest city
in America. Yeah, the locals, you know, they gripe about the influx of visitors, of new people coming to move here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. Most of those people have come from outside the area, like myself and you.
Yeah. A lot of transplants out here.
There's lots of transplants. There's not so many California natives anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Many people from all over the world have come here for the cannabis movement, for legal cannabis. I've met so many interesting people. It's really incredible, like the explosion of intellect and technology and ideas and
absolutely.
Growth, right? You get people talk from about nanotechnology to business law and politics
absolutely.
All in like five
and
minutes.
Guys like Chip and I get to have conversations with them now because marijuana is relevant as anything they have to talk about.
Oh yeah, it's great. And we've had such like a long time of being involved in the cannabis industry in some way, but not being able to talk about it, right? And not being able to speak to people publicly about it. Now our information is valued.
And rare.
And rare. I mean, both of us have a lifetime of involvement in the cannabis industry in some manner. Many people want to get involved in the cannabis industry right now. It's hard to gap 20 or 30 years of knowledge.
Absolutely.
Right? And with just a business plan.
Yeah.
Right.
And a pocket full of money.
Yeah. You see it. You see people come in and invest money into new businesses. You've seen people succeed. You've seen people fail.
Oh, yeah.
Right. What's the biggest hurdle to overcome?
Greed.
Like, I wasn't expecting you to say that.
Yeah.
Okay. Greed. Wow, well, that's such a different topic. But let's talk about greed.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone thinks they're going to make $1 million growing weed.
Yep.
Right?
And we already talked about it. You're growing money or you're growing weed?
Growing money or growing weed.
Yep.
And right? Quality cannabis will make you enough money.
Yes, sir. It hasn't led me astray yet. You know, right. I'm still eating well. It's something that I feel.
Did you bring any weed over here?
I did not bring any weed over here.
Damn.
Yeah, I should have.
All right.
I'm slacking.
That's cool. It's cool, bro. Other people, when they come to the show, they bring weed.
Podcast.
I thought you would, you know.
Yeah.
I just thought you'd be one of those people for some reason.
I brought weed over here yesterday for the
the prep session.
Yeah.
You did. You did. Thank you. That was good.
Yeah.
That was good.
But yeah, I'd say, you know, people who are the biggest thing I'm seeing with big industry right now, because this is now marijuana industry, as we keep talking about evolution, is it's big industry now. There's people in Denver who've made it with the mom and pop approach with no business plan, with just leasing a building in
2000 bucks in your pocket. Yep. I've heard the stories. Yep. They were my customers. I saw those people. I'll give them
shout outs, man. The guys, there's 100 different dispensaries of people that are absolute millionaires and stumbled upon it.
Happen.
But they all did it risking their neck, growing weed.
Right time, right place.
Being passionate about
something. Could have gone to jail at the time.
Yep. Absolutely. Right. Had every reason not to do it and did it and got successful for it. And if you go around like a quote unquote pioneers group of people in the industry, you could sure not know that they're some of the leaders of an industry, because it's people, you know, from every walk of life who were willing to roll the dice and not be greedy and got blessed for it, you know? And as we've become a big industry and big money's come into it, you know, people can try and hide behind the whole hippie vibe of marijuana or the whole feel good. You know, right, we're trying to do this because it's a beautiful plant, but
hey, bro,
they can't go more than 10 minutes without talking about
this $500 round.
Yeah, they can't. Everybody, you know, like I never fails. You meet with an owner of a company and they're like, you know, thinking about going into marijuana. We're really all about quality. We want to do everything the best. How much can we get? It's like, well, how do you need to know how much you can get if you only want the chronic? You know, like sometimes the chronic's not as much.
You don't get as big
yields, but people are all about bottom dollar, you know, and that's something that we're trying to really, my company and all my friends and the people I'm associated with are trying to sift our way through.
Yeah, this is something we talk about. Like, is it Budweiser or is it, you know, Pinot from Anderson Valley?
Absolutely.
Is it, you know, high-end product, or is it just mass-produced?
Totally.
You know.
And we're the minority, you know. Like, the majority of people are going to be interested in going out and getting a good Budweiser, something that they know is consistent. With marijuana, they don't want to get too high or not get high enough, so they want a consistent thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's where the import weed market has gone for years.
Yep.
Is people just like to get a little high. Right. You know, just after work, working hard, the doctors and lawyers and carpenters and such. And they come home and they take three hits, you know, on their joint that they rolled 4 days ago.
Yep.
They put it back in the ashtray and they go into the house and have a great evening. They've relaxed and
the midnight toker.
Yeah, the midnight toker. Absolutely. You know, that's most of America. That's most of the world.
Yeah.
People say it to me all the time. Oh, your stuff's too strong, Chip.
Yeah.
Right? And people tell you that totally. Too. Oh, is that Bickleweed? No, I don't know.
And that's why
I just have one hit.
That's why we have to, you know, that's why we have to be good at what we're good at. And also, you know that we ain't many. There's not a lot of us out there that are like, I want to get blasted off at 8 o'clock in the morning, all day long until I go to bed, you know, like, and not saying you have to do that every day, but if, you know, if you want to and you can function right and be a productive member of society, then you go get it, you know?
Yeah go for it. Supply and demand.
That's right.
Supply and demand. Yeah. This one thing that people underestimate on the cannabis market right now is how much demand is increasing.
Yeah, and how much supply is increasing too. It's a funny
absolutely.
Race.
It is a funny race. But locally, there's might maybe an infinite market, but in the visitors that you see come here.
Oh, unbelievable.
Right? It's unbelievable. All walks of life. People who've never used, you know, cannabis or haven't smoked a joint in 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years.
Our nation wants to get stoned. Yeah.
Everybody.
There's the one thing I've noticed about people coming here is there's so many people who won't smoke marijuana, even though they can get it illegally where they live and probably understand that they're not doing anything morally wrong. They won't break the law. And, you know, it's a funny thing because I my whole life was more than willing to break the law if morally it wasn't something that I had a problem with. And the easiest one for me there is marijuana. I never found that marijuana was anything wrong with it from the day I tried it. And so morally, I had no problem with purchasing it illegally. And all these people that are coming from out of town will only do it here, will only purchase it here because they're not breaking the law and they have no other problems with it. Our country needs to legalize marijuana.
Legalize it.
That's right. Who's listening? Go
and
tell your politician.
I'll advertise it. Come on, everybody. Legalize it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's talk about the supply, man. Here in Colorado, that's one of the conversations right now. It's wholesale market is changing rapidly.
Yeah.
Right.
That is due to the fact we dipped into it a little bit earlier, but vertical integration, the 70-30 law, was taken away from the recreational marijuana industry in October. And you help me with the dates, someone who's editing or something. But
I
believe it was October.
We'll have a fact checker on the website. And this is
But basically, that meant that you no longer had to produce any weed, and you could just purchase all your weed from somewhere else if you wanted to. I think this was a huge advantage for people that were terrible at growing pot because they could all of a sudden get all their product somewhere else. What they did along with getting rid of vertical integration is they started to allow people to purchase licenses for cultivation only. And that is where big industry started to happen. That's when basically that means that I can come in with my buddies, build a big, huge greenhouse, warehouse, you know,
big,
marijuana
huge
production
is how
facility.
Big? What's a big one?
150,000 square feet.
150,000 square feet of greenhouse.
Yeah, that's like that's a monster.
That is for
recreational
3 acres,
wholesale,
2 acres, two yeah. plus acres, 2.5 acres.
2.5 acres, all for production of wholesale marijuana. You have no longer do you have the responsibility or the burden of doing anything past growing it, putting it in a bag, and shipping it off and having it being sold.
Right.
I think
you're growing cabbages.
Precisely. And you're out of the retail market. And the vertical integration that was forced upon people earlier allowed a real crazy parallel because you could be the best grower in the world and have no clue how to run a retail store, and you could be the best retailer in the world and have no clue how to grow marijuana. And so there was a huge discrepancy. Now that's wiped out, but that allows big industry who never wanted to get involved in necessarily the retail side of things, that allows these people to come in and just make huge production facilities. And to an investor, to a businessman, to an outsider who was maybe going to roll the dice but was not sure, this was a sure thing. At the same time, about 6 months later, they started allowing out-of-state investing in Colorado. And that really blew the lid off things because now all of a sudden, there's a lot of risk takers out there who, you know, have sat around and watched this thing get big for a few years. And so they want to dive into it head over heels and, you know, make the biggest play they can with a bunch of investors. All of a sudden, we've got a ton of supply come flooding our state. There's countless counties that were issuing anybody a license for a wholesale production.
Pueblo County.
There's. I'm sure you're more familiar than I am actually with that type of thing. But it's just the lid blew off of it. And everybody and their uncle is building out a massive facility right now. And it's exciting, but it also leads me to wonder
where it's going, what's
going to
happen.
Where it's all going to go. Because when you look at the entire dollar amount of marijuana sold in Colorado in a year, and then these people's business plans, and you see that they have it like, you know, their bottom dollar, this $20 million a year is going to be like 20% of the entire market share. You just think that, and you see 20 of them a week, you start to scratch your head like, well, either the market share has to increase to $700 million for these people's business plans to look, you know, where they don't have 20% of an entire market, or somebody's going to fail.
So do you know how many people have licenses here? And grow licenses in Colorado?
I do not know the answer to that.
It's just a few thousand people. It's not that many. Last I looked, it was 2,000 people had a license to either grow or sell cannabis.
Yeah.
They're actually only about half the counties even allow you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the state doesn't even allow you to do it. Most of the western side, the western slope, as we call it here.
The red side.
The red side. They don't care much for ganja over there, brah.
Yeah, they want to keep their street and cities clean.
Hell yeah. I wonder if they're experiencing the same type of economic growth. You know, that's something I'm going to look into, man. I'm going to look into see what kind of economic growth is going on over there. I mean, they're a breadbasket of sorts. They grow a lot.
Yeah.
Right.
Ironically, some of the best parts of the state to grow, you know, outdoor cannabis aren't allowed. Could you imagine some Palisades?
Edit that. Okay. No, absolutely. Stone fruit areas. Oh man, totally.
It's, you know, there's some heartbreaker.
Yeah, there's a great cannabis production areas all through the western side, all through the western slope.
Yep.
Great production areas. It's unfortunate that some of those counties can't involve themselves in it.
Yeah.
Right. They're growing hemp over there though. They're growing some hemp over there.
Are they?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Nice. You can grow hemp in most counties of Colorado, I believe.
That's awesome. I'm definitely not a hemp specialist.
Yeah. And I mean, technically, you could grow cannabis in all counties in Colorado. It's just most counties decided.
Local jurisdictions.
Those local jurisdictions, yeah. And they decided their own fate, so to speak.
For those who wouldn't understand that, the entire state, the state as a whole, regulation department said, hey, marijuana is legal. They also wrote into the law that any local jurisdiction can override it if they so choose. So, you know, Chip is right. There's probably, it's more like a 75-25, maybe even 80-20. 80% of the people have not approved it and only 20% have. Ironically, there's some small towns in Colorado. One of my favorites is Oak Creek out by Steamboat. And they're such cool people. They had a small little town. They didn't have a school. They didn't have, you know, or the school they liked at least. And, you know, the roads were, a lot of them weren't paved. And they said, well, hell, let's legalize marijuana. And they have probably got 6 or 7 new facilities being built there right now in like a tiny little town. And it's going to bring so much money to them and so much taxes and, you know, make a better place for these people to live. So why not help yourself out?
You know, there's such this myth that marijuana is bad because what example does it give the children?
Yeah.
But here in Denver, it's given millions of dollars back to schools and education.
Absolutely.
Right. And in this town you're talking about, they're going to improve their educational platform.
Yep.
Right.
And
it's for the children. That's why we smoke, isn't it, Bickle?
It's for the kids.
It's for the kids.
Big love of kids.
Yeah, big shout out.
But, you know, I think the best way to put it is I heard a politician speaking to a room full of people about marijuana. And he said, treat it like alcohol, parents. You know, do you have your liquor sitting out to where your kids can get to it? Then it's your fault. You know, put your weed away. And that's...
Yeah, talk to your kids. Talk to your children.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, don't hide it.
It's one of those things, if you hide it from them, they're just going to want to know and do it. And if you can just be responsible and teach them that it's...
Here it is easier to talk to your kids about cannabis, yeah, though, in Colorado.
Yeah.
Because cannabis is legal.
Yeah.
Recreational cannabis is legal. Right, which is adult use. That's what they're calling the new bill in California, adult use.
Yep.
Right, and that's really the appropriate term.
Absolutely.
Adult use of cannabis.
Yes, sir.
Right, here they use marijuana to define it in the law.
Yeah.
Right, because that's the legal term, marijuana. Yep.
Marijuana.
Right.
It scares people.
Scares them off.
Marijuana.
All right, well, hey, let's have a break there. It's Real Dirt, Chip Baker. When we get back, we'll roll another one up. Matt Bickle. He's a smoker. He's a toker. He's a midnight toker. I don't think I got the lyrics right on that. He's a joker. He's a smoker. He's a midnight toker.
Sometimes the other hours too.
Yeah, and in between those hours. And lay, let's roll another one up, Matt. Look Word. What I got. Kirkwood OG.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other cool guests brought this by last week and left it.
What an amazing guest. So I'm breaking up the weed.
So you're going to break up the weed. Let's talk about this. Do you know this strain?
The Kirkwood OG. I honestly don't know it. I've smoked it. I like the bubble hash from it, but
This is Natural Remedies, right?
Yes, sir, it is.
Natural Remedies. Yeah, Jeff over there, he's a good buddy of mine.
Mr. Dank,
Jeff Dank. He's an awesome grower. I hope to have him on the show in the future. I've just reached out to him. He says yes, but I know he's got a kid. And
he just had twins also.
Oh, my gosh. He has got his hands full.
Yeah.
He's a propagator, huh?
Yeah.
Old Jeff Dank, propagating people and plants.
He made the golden goat. A lot of people are very familiar with that genetic.
The goat.
Goat, bro.
I love the goat. So the Kirkwood, do you know about this weed?
I don't. I wish I had something.
It smells good, though, doesn't it, when you...
Yes, sir, it does.
It has a complex...
It's one of the more diesel-y than lemony OGs, is what I would say. Like a L.A. Kush or Candy Kush, you're going to taste a lot of lemon, and this is really, really more of like the sour diesel kind of stinky armpit smell.
Yeah, it is skunky like that. That's why I like this one.
Yep, Chem Dog.
Diesel-like, Chem Dog-like.
Me and Chip are Chem Dog diesel type of guys.
Yeah, without that Chem Dog, without that diesel. If you ever want to stop by and smoke either one of us out, please do. Chem Dog diesel.
That's right.
Only the best, please.
We could do a whole segment on how I believe that sour diesel helped legalize marijuana in Colorado just about as much as any other reason. Obviously, I wouldn't take credit away from Mason and Steve and Christian and Brian, but...
No, you're right. Like, all that sour diesel was some of the... first readily available great weed that people were introduced to.
It was like Skunk One, Blueberry, Bubblegum, and you know, a lot of really good commercial marijuana that was skunky and tasted good. And sour diesel came around and left this flavor in your mouth for an hour and a half after you smoked it. And people to this day, I mean, everyone I know pretty much that lives out here that's been a part of marijuana was living somewhere else, smoked it, and moved here immediately, rented a house, and put 10 lights in their basement.
Right, Denver diesel.
Here's the broke-up weed
chip. Diesel is a predominant crop in Northern California as well because it's high demand.
Yep.
All over the country, all over the world, I'm sure people love diesel.
I can't tell you where I was standing when I smoked my first hit of any other strain except for sour diesel.
Where were you standing in the
Cervantes,
rain?
Cervantes, which is a live music venue here in Denver. And I was standing there next to my friend Fleeb Keith Thomas, who is an amazing musician and bass player around here. And he handed me a bowl of sour diesel and I inhaled and exhaled and started looking for the ounce in the mail after that, you know? It was the best weed I'd ever seen and tasted in my life. I feel like it's one of the old nostalgic ones, but we don't have to keep drooling and salivating over sour diesel anymore.
No, it's all good. I love sour diesel, and it's been around for years. I mean, it's existed as a clone for 20 plus years, maybe. It's an old school strain now, you know. But back in 2000, late 90s, it was still up and coming. There weren't clone bars and seed companies and friends who had it yet. It was still closely guarded. Only a few people had it. Diesel, OG Kush, Bubba Kush, all of those.
Yeah. And right. I'd say up until about 2008 or 9, when the big medical revolution happened in Colorado, that it was better than currency. It was better than money. You know,
you could trade your way into anything way.
You could. We would smoke bowls in the car before we walked in somewhere and blow it all over ourselves and put a nug in our pocket and walk in places just to stink as bad as you could, because you wouldn't have to pay for your meal. You wouldn't have to, everybody was dying to get a piece of the weed that smelled like that.
Oh, no doubt. Do you remember
the basketball game.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Nuggets game.
Should you tell the story or me?
You know, I think we should tell it together.
Okay.
Right?
So I had a box to a Nuggets preseason, not even a regular season game. It was a preseason game, and they were playing at the Broomfield Event Center. And so my buddy, it's not a big, you know, nothing to lose your mind over. I'd say there's maybe a total of 15,000 people there. And I invite Chip and Pete to come up, and Chip comes up, and you can take it from here for a minute.
So here's the way I see it. Is Bickle calls me up. He's like, yo, bro, we're going to go to the Nuggets game, man. Let's go puff at the game. I'm like, oh, sweet, dude. We can puff at the game. He's like, sure, bro. We always puff in at the game. Right? So, you know, I'd been living in Northern California for a number of years. I literally took him for that when he said we can puff at the game.
I meant like outside during halftime and shit.
So I came only slightly prepared. I had 5 joints in my front pocket.
Doesn't know about a dupe case, which maybe a lot of people don't know about, but I'm a big fan of the, you know, some sort of smell-proof, waterproof case to put your dupes in.
I just had joints in my pocket and was going to go smoke them.
Really, really fresh, loud-ass weed. So he's stinking this place up like you wouldn't. I mean, it's like
we're in the box.
We're in a box, and it's like we're trimming a 5-pound fucking harvest in this box is what it smells like. And we're not even smoking weed in there. We're, you know, we would go out at halftime or before the game, we'd smoke plenty, but this smells like
we hadn't smoked any weed.
Yeah, not a piece.
Because it started as soon as we get in this box.
Yeah.
Right. As soon as we get in it, they start serving us, and the server comes around, and they make a comment about, yeah. Oh, hey, you guys can't smoke weed in here.
Like, we're not.
We're like, yeah, sure, we're not going to smoke weed in here, right? So my feelings immediately, you know, were hurt because I thought we're going to puff weed in this box.
So at some point, it smelled so good in there that the police decided to come see us, and the cops come in, and they're convinced that we had smoked marijuana in the box because
convinced.
It smelled so bad.
Convinced. All right. Yeah. All right. Boy, like, who's smoking the marijuana?
And they're looking in the trash can for fucking cashed out bowls, and like, we're like, dude, we really haven't smoked. My favorite part of this story is Justin Brunson, who's the owner of Old Major and Masterpiece Deli here in Denver, a couple of amazing restaurants. Great. Justin's at the game with us.
He just walked in the door 20 minutes before.
Yeah, and he decides to explain to the police officers that there's no way we were smoking pot, and the way to tell is to smell his hands, and shoved his hands in this police officer's face. Which, like, any years later would have probably got him shot. Now, that night, the cop jumped back and, like, was ready to detain him. And Justin's like, smell my hands, man, see? Because, you know, if you've been smoking a bunch of weed, then your hands smell like weed usually. So the police...
I remember correctly, Justin acted completely wasted, though. He went from sober to, like... From like, hey man, what are you guys doing? Oh, hey man, yeah, dude, we ain't smoking weed, man. We just smell my fingers.
Yeah. So, long story, we end up, no one gets arrested, no one goes to jail, and we didn't get to smoke weed in the box. But we smoked weed in a lot of boxes, just not during Nuggets games.
Right.
You know, like Pink Floyd shows.
Well, the way I remember it ending, though, is. After you know, he had the fingers in the cop's face, he says, nah, man, it was those people down there, right? And he points out of the box. And for some reason, this made sense to the police because, you know, there was this draft that was created every time the door was open. So they go look at the people down below us, and they were just the most conservative, you know, people. They were definitely older. They were in suits. You know, there was no way they were the ones with weed.
It was definitely right. Us.
But for a moment, the police thought that it was the people in front of us.
One moment in time. That's awesome. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, you know, ironically, or I don't know if that's the proper use of the phrase, but years later, I was in that same box with you and some of those same people. And now it's 2014, 15, and we're throwing joints to people.
Yeah, and weed is legal. That was with the Dank guys.
Totally. Justin, it was their box beforehand. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, right, because I got the call.
That's who we got the tickets from.
Yeah, that's who we got the Nuggets. I got the call a couple days later, and I was like, oh, shit, that was your box. I did not know that.
My bad.
My bad. Right.
Cops are coming.
Yeah. I think Greg was like, I don't care. Smoke me out.
Yeah. Pay me back in weed.
Oh, here you go. So it's changed a lot from when it started here in 2009. Technology's changed. The politics have changed.
The growers have changed.
The growers ain't changed.
No, they
growers
haven't.
In 5 points don't change. We talk about this all the time because I'm a technology guy. I build technology for production of this type of stuff. Grow lights, soil, nutrients. I've made all kinds of stuff in the past. Bickle sees all types of new technologies. We also hear all the fish stories of all the technologies and how this technology, this fertilizer, this light is going to increase.
Revolutionize.
But there have been some revolutions in this industry.
Absolutely.
Right? Earlier you mentioned a smell, right? Previously we didn't have any way to keep the cannabis from smelling because it smells so bad it smells so good.
Yeah.
when it's flowering. Carbon filters came along to counteract that, did a really good job. With legal cannabis, though, people don't care.
Yeah, depending on where you're at, a lot of, like, I'd say 90% of the grows don't have a smell issue. There's definitely, downtown Denver.
Don't have a smell issue, meaning they don't care.
Meaning that they're not receiving any.
Stink the block out.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you'll drive the streets in Denver and it stinks.
Reeks of marijuana.
Reeks of weed growing.
Yeah, I-70, the airport drive. From
all the industrial areas.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, it's great.
I love it.
Roll the windows down, you get year-round fragrance.
That's right. Right. That's right. But yeah, I'd say that, a lot of the technology coming into what I see, past smell is a ton of cooling technology, HVAC technology, lighting technology, also a ton of IT stuff. I'd say that we're almost probably a little diluted in some of these places as far as you have to go through and sift through a lot of bullshit to find out what's good because we got invaded so fast by so much cool technology, cool industry people. Every single person you meet is selling you something that could revolutionize the entire industry and could be a complete failure.
You always see him in the shop all day.
Yeah. And it's our job is kind of, veterans to this thing to
sniff it out, right?
Sniff it out, not get too excited, and also not be closed-minded. Because if we said fuck this to everything, we'd still be growing the way we were 10 years ago, and the pot wouldn't get any better, and we wouldn't become a more efficient industry. And there's definitely a fine line between industry and connoisseur growing. And, I want to take connoisseur growing as far as I can at a producible, mass producible level. Now, I'm not going to put myself in charge of, facilities that are going 200,000-300,000 square feet of cultivation. I don't feel like that's my niche or that's my strength, but anybody that wants to keep it, under 100 and try and grow really quality weed and isn't afraid to put money into the technology to make the room better, to make computers do more work, then I think it's doable.
Right. So that's the secret to growing great cannabis and to grow in bug-free cannabis and to grow multiple crops is being able to control your environment.
Exactly.
HVAC systems, HVAC systems, heating and air systems, dehumidifying systems, crucial and key in areas like Denver.
It's
right?
Massive.
It's hot and it's cold here and you still got to keep your room at 72 degrees.
Yeah.
Right. What was the temperature today? I mean, it's almost 100 degrees today.
Yep.
And 6 months from now, it might be minus 10.
Yep. And you got to be prepared for both of those problems.
For both of those problems, right.
And, up until 10 years ago, maybe 5 years ago would probably be a better way to put it, most, you know, every single grow was cooled and heated with the same technology that heats and cools your home.
Right. Absolutely.
And your house.
Even today, many grow rooms are exactly like that.
Oh yeah. Most of them, you know, whoever the people that don't want to pony up, and that's most people, and the people that have existing with the old technology facilities that they just don't feel necessary to upgrade. And if you can imagine an air conditioner is,
because these upgrades are, I mean, it's not inexpensive.
$100,000 to $300,000 to upgrade 10-20,000 square feet of cultivation.
Right. You know, it's $300,000, right?
Yeah, it's nothing to incur that expense, because it's every single piece of the puzzle has to be changed out for a new one, because all of a sudden, you know, your lights don't work. The old vented lights don't work anymore with the new ACs. You need to get the new lights that aren't vented, that, you know, put off way more heat. And but with the right amount of HVAC and technology, you can cool them much easier. And it's a huge problem that people have something that is up and running and producing marijuana and already paid for, and it's old technology and it's beat up, but it's what works, and they don't want to reinvest.
Right. Absolutely. It's paid for, bought and paid for, but literally it's the difference between like maybe a pound a light
to 3 pounds,
to 3 pounds a light.
Yep.
Right. 'Cause that is possible. And I mean, I actually believe 3.9 pounds is as much as I've seen verified.
Yeah.
Right. But that is possible. Certain strains, perfect conditions, awesome grower, but hey, you got to have that premium light, that premium environment.
If it's not, it's the technology that gets those numbers, it's not the grower.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the money you invest into your product that's going to get you those numbers. There's nothing I can do. I have a formula that can grow really good weed, but it only grows as much as the environment lets it grow. It's not going to, I can't add some sort of nutrient that's going to make the bud get a pound bigger per light. The only thing I can do is make the room cool enough and have the right environment and make it right.
Right. We talk about this too. This is our conversation. Environment. Yep. How are these people fucking up? Environment. How are these people fucking up? Yeah. Environment.
Environment and stay out of the way. That's what I tell people. If you can make a really good environment and stay out of the way, you'll probably, and have good genetics. That's probably the last piece of the puzzle.
Genetics.
Oh, right. Man. But those three things, weed grows itself. The shit grows in sidewalks, folks. You know? It's our job to optimize the conditions for it and stay out of the way.
Yeah, but there is a connoisseur level of it. Weed does grow itself, so to speak, but only when you put the proper technology, the proper environment, the proper thought and care and organization into planning out the cycle.
Yep.
That's the only way it grows carefree.
Absolutely.
Right? Or careless. Now, that's a different story, but, you know.
Careless is no good.
It's hard to grow quality cannabis in a careless manner.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yep. And if you're not the cleanest guy and not the most, you know, I don't know, attention to detail and cleanliness are things that get looked over so easily here, because the irony is it's not hard to grow shitty weed. It's not at all.
Right. If you can sell it, yeah, who cares?
Yeah. And right? So for
the
years,
mentality.
You thought you were an expert because you grew it and you sold it and someone paid you for it. And that validated in your head that you grew good weed.
Absolutely.
When in fact, you're growing shit and people just, you know, are validating you through money.
Yeah. Living in Northern California, I saw this happen for years. People from all over the country came there. And wherever they were the shit grower. They had their strain, a skunk one or blueberry, right? Which is so 10 years ago at that time. And they came into the area and they're like, oh man, I grow the dank. And they immediately get their ass handed to them, right? The quality, the thought of quality is so much higher pace there at the time than it was any place else. And it still is now, right? The demand for quality is there for sure, even though the production's also in Northern California as well.
Yeah.
Right. It's that demand, the quality that makes us keep going for it, man.
Yeah.
So we got HVAC systems, double-ended lights, you know.
Full room controls from your cell phone.
Yeah. Full environmental controls. People ask me about LED lights, but you never see those, or hardly ever see those.
Not really.
Right, no. Right.
LEDs making a run at the industry right now, But it's the same thing that was happening 10 years ago with the regular lights, in my opinion. Now, this is strictly my opinion, but I just watched the lighting technology change so much. And now the double-endeds, in my opinion, for me, have risen to the top. They're like kind of the best bang for your buck. And now this is happening in LEDs again. Whereas, you know, 5-6 years ago, if I'd have bought every light that sounded like a good idea to me, I think I might have gotten my butt kicked as far as replacing them over and over and over and waiting and holding my breath a little bit and then seeing what comes my way. I feel like, you know, we've gotten to see the cream rise at the top a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. We sell so many double-endeds. It's the only thing we sell really these days. Few people buy the older technology any longer. We have some air-cooled customers, don't get me wrong. People with low ceilings, they're forced into having air-cooled lights as opposed to double-ended lights.
Well, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag for all you folks that want to know how to get 3 pounds of light that are sitting there scratching your head, is that with old technology, a vented hood, the footprint that it puts out would require about 3 to 4 of those lights for the same footprint as a double-ended light. And a double-ended light, just imagine you get to take out 4 lights and put 1 light in that same place. So where it would take 4 pounds under those first 4 lights to get, you know, a pound of light, now you only have to get, you know, if you get 4 pounds off the same spot, you got 4 pounds off of 1 light. So,
right, because it's just square foot. It's square foot.
It's a footprint. And you have one light has the footprint of 4 lights. And so you can get 1 pound of light off of 4 lights, or you can get 4 pounds of light off of 1 light. And that's your magic number. And so invest in technology, folks.
Invest in technology. It is simple math. There's a bunch of ways that you can say it. But with the DE lights, we promote people all the time, no matter which brand they're getting, the 1,000-watt sun, the Yield, the Phantoms. There's others out there, some I won't mention, but no matter which ones they're getting, we suggest 4x6 area for one light, or 5x5 area for one light.
Exactly.
Right? And if you do the math on a 5x5 area, that's 25 square feet, right? And you grow 2 ounces per square feet under 1,000 watt, that's 50 ounces under one light. Help me with my math there. What's that? 50 ounces. 48 ounces is 3 pounds. 16 ounces is a pound. 48 ounces is 3 pounds.
Yeah.
So 3 pounds and 2 ounces. If you can just grow 2 ounces a square foot.
Yeah.
Right. It's simple math.
That's crazy.
Right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But traditionally, people grew in 4x4 areas with one light, 1,000-watt light.
Yep.
And that's 16 square feet times 2, 32. That's the same, you know, same math, same formula, right? But they're, you know, getting right at 2 pounds.
Yeah. And that's killing it with those old lights.
Oh, you're killing it.
And you have to have everything right. It's so easy to get less than a pound of light if you're not crushing. And that's what I see. Most places are at a pound of light with old technology, 2 pounds of light with new technology.
Man, what do you think one thing people could change in their production? Like, you can't go into all the fertilizer or all the media or the environment, but is there one, like, tip you could give somebody on, like, hey, if I want to get higher yields, what's the, like, thing you see people do to increase their yield?
Increase their humidity and here in temperature, Denver, especially in
control
Denver.
Control the environment. Back to the environment.
Exactly.
Always
the
environment.
I would say environment is the biggest thing, and also one from left field is I always tell growers, stop trying to be an artist. Like, you know, I feel like they have this canvas and they think they're going to paint their perfect picture on it. And it's like, if you can just reproduce the steps, if you can do the things that, you know, that make it successful every time and not try and change the process every time to have a unique art to it. If that's how you have to approach, you know, getting good numbers out of large scale marijuana facilities. There is a process that's happened already before you and ahead of you. And if you can you know, adapt to that. And it doesn't have to be any specific one process, just, you know, something that your company has used, your facilities used that worked, because there's so many problems even within a single facility, so many curveballs with, you know, in every little microclimate that, you know, stick to something easy and don't try and be the magic man.
Magic man. You're right. Everybody wants to pull out the magic.
And wants to find something at the grocery store on the shelves that's got the coolest looking bottle that they think
absolutely
is going to be
the newest, best stuff.
Yeah. And there's people out there selling. And once it works for you, you become a salesman. And so, you know, and the fact is, the guy selling it to you, who it worked for, really is selling it, and it really did work for him. And so you just got to be careful, man. It's a slippery slope. And when you change too many factors, you don't know what you changed.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. What's the most common grow technique you see?
Yeah, well, funny enough, most people are growing with your lights and your soil blend. I would say that, you know, like we spoke about the double enders, everybody's switching to those. The only thing you have to do is be able to catch up with the heating and air conditioning, because they're a little bit harder to keep cool, but totally worth it, because you can take so many more lights out and light a room with less. And then most people are using the cocoa fiber perlite mix that you made, and it's just absolutely a crusher. I think the ability to get to dry your plants out is something that people are finally catching up on. And well, I wouldn't say everybody, but a lot of the wise guys are realizing that you can't keep a plant soaked and saturated with the high PPM all day long and expect it to do good.
Do you see straight cocoa out there?
You do as much as, I'd say, you know, a third is straight cocoa, and then two thirds is your perlite cocoa mix.
Okay, awesome. Most of that stuff relies on chemical fertilizer, though.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I'd say all of it does.
A lot of it does.
There's some people like trying to top feed with earthworm castings, and that use a compost tea from time to time in it, but I'd say that 90 to 95% of what goes into the cocoa is fertilizer.
Fertilizer, synthetic fertilizer. Yeah. We sell lots of House of Garden.
Yeah.
Lots of Botanicare product. Yeah.
I've been using a House and Garden hybrid mix for probably over 10 years that we've been slowly adjusting and working out a formula with it. And it's House and Garden's A and B, but we use, you know, a few different products from a few different people, and some of the House and Garden stuff and not some of the House and Garden stuff.
Right. Yeah. House and Garden's great product. Incredible instructions.
Yeah.
Steve Geeter, he's on the show. He was on one of the earlier episodes.
Yeah.
We didn't even go into this on that show, but I know he created that nutrient formula and built that whole system originally for the U.S. Now they own it, and it's in Humboldt County.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're cooking.
He's done well for himself, man. And I would, if I was...
And for the industry.
Yeah. Almost everybody I know is using some form of it, or, you know, part of the recipe.
Right, right. There's a little bit of everything, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
People making their own concoctions.
You see it on the large scale facilities.
Right. Blending their own soil, blending their own nutrients.
Yeah. You have to almost, when you start looking at a business plan, and like we talked about a long time ago, that the profit margins were at 90% when you were vertically integrated and growing all your own in 2010. And now the profit margins are much smaller. People are finally just reaching out for realistic ones. And an easy way to do that is cutting production costs and producing your own salts and mixing your own dirt.
Right. Absolutely. Whole nother beast, whole nother industry for sure. You have to develop for yourself. That's what happens with industry, though, is you start to grow.
Yeah.
And you need your own supply, packaging product or pallets, and you decide to build that.
Yeah.
Right.
And
same thing with the cannabis. Yeah. Yeah. So did Rockefeller. Right. Yep. Absolutely. So we have gone over so much stuff today, man. We have gone over the politics, the history, the technology, the money, the greed. I absolutely believe this is going to be one of my most listened to and re-listened to broadcasts. And we haven't even gotten to what you are an expert in. Right. Every one of my show has a featured expert, and we've had so much other stuff to chat about, but you are a connoisseur of concentrates.
I would say so.
Of hashishes, of oils,
yes,
of waxes,
yes,
and you've been this for a long time. I know people have been into this, started beginning to concentrates, waxes and chatter. It's the newest thing.
Absolutely.
Right. But I know you were one of the first people to introduce the vaporization technique that you use, the dabbing technique, to me years ago.
I definitely was lucky enough to learn about it at a pretty early age. I fell in love with Moroccan hash over in Amsterdam, and my tolerance was so low at that age that like I couldn't hardly smoke the shit, you know. It was like taking sleeping pills basically. and I got to a point where I knew it tasted better. I knew the high was a little bit more uplifting, and I didn't know anything else besides, you know, I wanted as much hash as I could. I've always gone to Amsterdam, would still go. I'll put a shout out to the Noon. It's a Noon coffee shop right behind the Rijksmuseum. And they sell big, huge blocks of Moroccan hash, and they cut it off with a machete, and you can buy sticks of it. And you basically light it on fire like a candle and then blow it out and smear it on your hand like an eraser. And then take that, because it's really hard and solid, and take that and sprinkle it on a joint or on some tobacco. And it is just an absolutely incredible, uplifting buzz. And that's kind of what made me fall in love with it at a young age. And then we always made bubble hash growing. And a lot of growers for years, I mean, I can't tell you how many growers I know that have thrown away millions of dollars worth of trim because they saw no value in it. They were making so much money off the flower, they couldn't look past, you know, the flower, and they just tossed the trim in the trash. And we used to literally get people's trim for free, make bubble hash out of it, and smoke it. And again, you know, I didn't know anything about percentages at that time. I'm a young kid. And, now we know through technology that the best weed on the planet's, you know, around 30% THC, and that some good bubble hash is 90% THC. And all of a sudden it's a no-brainer that why it would made so much sense back then. But we always smoked bubble hash and loved it. And then came the old butane hash, which, you know, everyone is very familiar with. And just to do a little explaining of terminology, I like to do this for pretty much everyone I meet that doesn't know, is that the word hash is like in the same sense that marijuana is called cannabis, bud, herb, dank, nugget, pot, you know, on and on and on. The same thing with hash is that hash is just the crystals off of marijuana, and hash is oil, earl, shatter, wax, butter, what any other name that you can think of that you've heard that you think is something extract, else besides hash. Yeah, it's just hash. It's right, the crystals off the pot. Chip knows this very well, but I think it's something that is overlooked a lot with people, and so I think it's worth explaining. So
yeah, it's complex. It's complex terminology.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll be the next segment of our show.
Nice. when we go deep.
Yeah, when
we but go deep. Right now I think that, you know, basically BHO and then CO2 oil both kind of really did revolutionize marijuana.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not just the dabbing culture, but the vape pens.
Yep.
To be able to like have some concentrated cannabis and take a hit of it wherever you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, hash has been like the leader in cannabis consumption for thousands of years because it was easier to store.
Yep.
Right. You know, flowers of marijuana only, cannabis only last for a short period of time.
Yeah.
No matter what you do to it.
And a real simple way I like to explain that what hash and flower is that it flower is plant matter and then hash is the crystals on the plant matter. And so, you know, a good way to explain it is we could go out in your yard right now and pick up a handful of grass and smear some hash on it, and that's bud. And, you know, if you're able to take that those crystals off of that flower and smoke the THC without having to combust the plant matter, you have a much cleaner way of smoking and a much more concentrated effect, and also a much more concentrated size or volume of your package, which is what you were just talking about.
It's definitely a different chemical reaction than smoking flower, whole plant matter.
Yeah.
Right. Than just the concentrated THC.
Yeah.
And traditionally, hash was just the crystals, right, that were pulled off the buds or the leaves in some manner, either by sieving them or hand rubbing them or washing them off. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's several million other techniques that our listeners will give us when they listen to this.
Keith? You didn't say what this, about Sister Keith, man.
Yeah, right, man. We're rocking 00. So, but the new technology really use some type of solvent,
mm-hmm.
right? Makes a really pure extract of this prop of THC from the plant matter.
Yes.
So it's not just the crystals anymore. Yeah. It's the whole plant matter.
Totally.
Right. And they get terpene complex, which are all the secondary compounds responsible for the flavor and the smell.
Yeah.
Right.
They can isolate all the different kinds. They can remove the terpenes and reintroduce them. And you'll definitely, and I'm sure your listeners will get an earful from another expert way over my head in the production of it and the science of it. I can tell you just as a smoker and as a connoisseur that for me, it's always been about flavor. And the best flavor on the planet is a good low temperature hit of concentrate. I don't think anybody would argue great. That because you can take away all the plant matter flavor and all the, you know, the
carbs. Did you bring some over?
You know, I didn't, bro. So for everyone who's hating on me right now, I live 4 blocks from Chip. And so if we needed to like push pause and take our headphones off, I have like 65 pounds of hash in my house.
He's bragging. If I called him out on that, he'd only have like 12.
Actually, I'm
around the world. Around the world.
Around the world is taking a dab of every kind of hash you have at your house. And there was a time when it was a pretty big feat at my house.
Yeah, it's kind of like a funneling a keg at a keg stand funnel or something, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Holding your breath, keg stand funnel. So the new rise in concentrates is this solvent extraction, which is either CO2, which is a gas, but at pressure it acts as a solvent,
mm-hmm.
or it's alcohol of some sort,
butane
of some sort, propane of some sort, or there's new technologies, old technologies maybe, of water pressure, heat.
Yep.
All of these things now are yielding this extract.
Yeah.
Rosin.
Rosin's pressed out. So rosin, it's like a heat press.
Heat press, you know, a full melt bubble. I mean, oh man, full melt bubble is awesome. And they just, some of the best, cleanest hash going. It's just water extracted.
Yep.
Right.
And then you can make rosin out of with full melt bubble.
Yeah, right.
Where you take the bubble hash and press it out and press the oils out of it, which is very tasty.
Very tasty. But you get to smoke all of these things on a, how do you explain this to someone who doesn't know? It's a dab rig. What is a dab?
So 50% of the people listening will know what a hot knives are and 50% won't. But if you've ever taken two knives and put them on a stove and heat them up and then put some weed in between them or some hash in between them and then inhale the heat, you basically have a heating element, something that's hot, and then it's hotter than the whatever you're trying to smoke. And then you put what you're trying to smoke on there and it melts it. And that's what dabbing is.
With this concentrated.
Absolutely.
Right.
With the concentrated hash or marijuana. And so you take the reason it's actually called dabbing is because you take a small dab piece, like a tiny little dab of it, and then you also dab it onto the top of the heating element. But what you're doing
pencil
is
prick.
Yeah, you're taking something, quartz, titanium glass that you can smoke this marijuana off of that won't burn, that can hold heat. You heat it up to a certain temperature. I prefer a very low temperature because it preserves the flavor so much more. And then you add the concentrate to the heating element and inhale at the same time, and you breathe the smoke off of it, and that's what gets you stoned. And it also tastes absolutely phenomenal.
Really stoned, though. Do you remember your first dab? Tell me about your first dab.
First dab was in a hotel room, and it was the, if anyone remembers, there was a glass stick, and you would heat the glass stick up, and then you had a bowl that looked just like a marijuana bowl, except for there was no hole in the bottom of it. There was holes around the sides, and you put hash down in the bottom, and then you heated up this glass rod and touched it down on the hash and breathed in. And I just remember the flavor being like you know, twice as good as anything I've ever tasted in my life. And then I remember being uncomfortably stoned for about 2 hours and thinking to myself, like an hour and a half into it, like, that's something just rocked my world, you know? That was my first dab.
That was your first dab.
Yeah. And I was young and innocent.
Right. And that technology is really taking over the head shop industry.
It's taken over everything. It's taken over the cultivating industry, because all of a sudden you don't have to grow beautiful marijuana that has to be presentable in a jar and smell like dank in a jar and be burned clean in a bowl.
Absolutely right.
You can grow total crap and blast it into hash. And if you don't know any better, out of a vape pen with glycol mixed in it, you know, in a cartridge, it tastes all right. It gets you high. People don't give a shit. And that's, again, going back to the, like, you know, are you a Budweiser guy or are you not, you know?
Right, because the glycol is used as a cutting agent maybe not a cutting agent is the correct term, but...
It allows it to be viscous enough to smoke into in a cartridge, in a vape pen. We're referring to just vape pens. And basically, if you stick really good hash in a vape pen, only the part that's next to the heating element will melt because it's not liquidy enough. And so they mix glycol with the hash to make it liquidy enough to run down onto the heating element. So every time you inhale, it burns it.
Inhale, exhale.
Just got an ounce in the mail.
Yeah, the vape pen is incredible. It really has brought cannabis consumption to so many people, and it's going to continue to. I know there's concerns over the health issues and usage of it. I'm a proponent. I'm not a proponent of it one way or the other.
Yeah.
I like the technology. I like anything about cannabis and weed. I'm not going to say anything about it's bad, right?
And it's a time and place thing.
It's a time and place, man. Like
when you're on vacation with your grandmother at Disney World.
It's perfect.
Yeah, you rip that vape pen all day long, and she has no clue, and you're high as hell. But like if I'm sitting in my house enjoying a movie, I'm not going to be smoking off of a glycol vape pen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like I just won't. Now, here's the good news, is that I'm working with some companies around the country who are smart enough and wise enough, and I have to assume that there's more than just these guys that are pushing hard on the technology end of every aspect of marijuana, but these people specifically with vape pens, and there's going to be advances in it, and eventually we will get the iPhone of the vape pen, which is
it's coming, you know, right? I've seen some of those technologies.
Just some Cadillac incredible vape pen that works perfect, that you can smoke hash out of without glycol, and so everyone just sit back and wait because it's coming.
So how do you puff on it when you get high, when you smoke out, how do you do that?
I usually am a hash concentrate guy until the evening. This is stereotypically. And then throughout the day, I will not hide behind it. I'm not ashamed.
Dabber. You're a dabber.
I have very cereal bad ADD. Dabber. I wake up in the morning.
Look, he's justifying himself.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, whatever,
but
bro.
I'm saying, like,
we're all adults here.
On my best day, I would smoke 10 dabs in a day by the evening, and on my, you know, normal day is probably 3 a day. And I do like to get up and like go work out and then get stoned.
You're such a stereotypical stoner. You're smoking weed all day long. Yes. All right, so here's Bickle's schedule. Bickle gets up 8 o'clock. Gets up 7 o'clock, walks the dogs, goes, works out for an hour or so, eats a ton of food, probably goes and like bicycles or runs or goes some to a meeting, does a bunch of meetings all day long, goes all over the state helping people grow weed. In the afternoon, comes back, works out again, eats another shitload of food, goes and takes the dogs on a big ass walk.
It's like you rewind the day and then fast forward it. I'm an exerciser. It keeps me sane. And I am an ambitious businessman who will go anywhere to the far reaches of the earth to help grow good pot.
Oh, yeah, man. I've been motivated by your workout technique and skill and duration and time more than any others. I keep struggling to get on the Coach Bickle bandwagon, the boat. Right.
Shout out to Lodo CrossFit.
Yeah, so many other people have been motivated by you. I mean, we could count the numerous people that you have influenced to lead a healthier lifestyle.
Well, it's the same thing with plants, man. You know, in a pesticide world, it's do you want to give your plants antibiotics before they're sick, or do you want to give your plants vitamins, or give them after they're sick, or give them vitamins before they're sick? And that's the difference in pest sprays is, you know, organic pest management is before they're sick, you give them good vitamins, and illegal pesticides are antibiotics after they're sick. And that's how I try and treat my body. It's how I try and treat my plants. And, you know, that's something that health is wealth. I will tell you that. Everyone write that one down.
Health is wealth. Yeah, I've felt the best when I've eaten the healthiest and been the strongest, exercised, worked out, moved the most in my life. That's for sure.
Yep. And the healthiest plants make the healthiest weed. And
absolutely.
It tastes the best and gets you the most stone.
So in our industry, there's often this terminology, these interesting phraseologies that people have, and a lot of it's slang or lingo that you and your friends have developed, and it's blossomed out into something different. Do you have any special terminology you use?
A good one would definitely be Earl.
Earl?
Smoking Earl.
Smoking Earl.
I've heard,
smoking Earl.
I'm not going to sit here and say that we invented the name Earl for hash oil. But I'd never heard it before, and we made it up, and, you know, you hear it all over the place.
Conscious Collective.
Yeah. I've heard it to other, you know, I'm sure multiple groups of people invented
Earl.
But hash oil, you know, in the industry, there's a whole vocabulary. There's a dictionary's worth of vocabulary in terms and lingos that, like, it's literally like, you know, the government was like, all right, we're going to make you guys learn our own Japanese version of this language. And, you know, something completely foreign to everyone else.
Right.
And then, you know, but there is no, unfortunately, no translators of Japanese or no one that even speaks Japanese in this industry, if you will. And all of a sudden we have this problem where we have to learn this terminology overnight
to
communicate with each other. And it's absolutely beautiful to see how many people can talk the lingo now, you know,
right.
Metric, for instance, like we've been speaking about the tracking system, or, you know, like just the different RFID tags and package tags and labels and all these different words, like tamper evident containers versus a childproof container versus a
those are all normal industry words, though.
They are, but to our industry and specific to our product, it's something that's so foreign and new.
Okay, yeah. I see that. You're absolutely right. That's an interesting perspective. Usually people come on and they say whatever is their pet name for smoking weed or growing weed or slinging weed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a little
That's what we called in high school. You want to go talk to Joe?
Hey, we're talking to Joe, man. Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't smoke weed in high school, not till after I was 21.
Not till it was legal, bro.
Not till it was legal. So around the grow room, do you know any words, any terminologies?
Yes, LARF is a favorite one.
LARF. I'm sorry, LARF.
LARF, a word that has no other meaning in the world.
No other meaning in the world.
Besides. Lower unwanted marijuana buds that are better tossed in with the trim than they are trimmed and given to someone to sell and smoke.
Right. Look, undeveloped bottom buds.
Yes.
That don't receive the light.
Say it in a sentence, please. That plant looked a little larfy at the bottom. Maybe we should have trimmed it up a little more.
Oh, man, this sack's all larf.
Yeah, yeah. Man, these motherfuckers are selling me larf, man. And the opposite of larf would be the big, huge colas on top that are, you know, the big trophy nuggets. And
trophy nuggets.
Larf is one. Let's think of another one. You know, a good
you just said nugget.
Yeah, nugget.
That's the good stuff.
The good stuff. blasting it.
Blasting.
Yes. Blasting is blasting. A term for making it into hash. And where, you know, 10 years ago you would trim every piece of LARF. Now you know every the terminology, LARF, right? So you can follow along here.
Small little nuggets.
You can take the LARF and blast it into hash. And all of a sudden you have not ripped anyone off because all the LARF has gone to being made into hash, blasted. And it makes that, you know, all you're selling is your good nugs.
Yeah, previously your dealer sold you the LARF and kept the big buds for himself. Yeah,
exactly.
Kept the nuggets for himself. Now you know if you're in that situation currently.
I'm going to confess that I did that throughout the entire 2000s, early 2000s.
Hey, not security. Really. Security.
No.
Could we take Pickle out of here, please?
I definitely
show's over. We're out of here.
Yeah. Pack it up, man.
Pack it up. All right. We're done with this.
But no, that was the glow. Man, if you grew it, you better kept the favorite nuggets or you're a silly man. But if you grew it right, all the nuggets were good. And so blasting is another one.
Blasting.
Let's think of another one. There's lollipopping and topping.
Lollipopping and topping.
And that's like my, if that's I were to teach two techniques in a grow room, it would be those two only, and not overwatering would be right. The third. But lollipopping a plant is literally making each stalk or each branch look like a lollipop, which would be nothing all the way up the stick until the very top. And then there's just, you know, that only growth. So you pick off all the lower growth on every branch. And then topping is the opposite process, which is you pick the lead growth out of every branch. And every time you pluck out a lead growth, it'll split into two pieces and make for double the tops. So topping and lollipopping.
Top it, lollipop, don't overwater, don't be greedy. There you go, secret to success.
Don't grow and sell LARF, and if you have to do it, blast that shit.
Great, those are some great terminologies. Thanks. Make sure you use your child-proof, tamper-evident.
So child-proof packaging. Is for the consumer. Tamper-evident is for the industry. Whenever we transport marijuana, we have to put tamper-evident tape on it. And so that way, if you were to show up with you leave with a pound of weed, you put tamper-evident tape on it, you show up at the next place, the cops know you have not been opening the box and smoking it while you're driving.
Back to the regulations.
Regulate.
Man, you got any... you got a weed story for me?
Weed story.
Yeah, like weed story.
So I am a freshman in college.
Good weed story.
I am going to fly to Amsterdam for spring break for my first time ever to Amsterdam. And I don't get a hotel room, don't make a single plan, just buy a plane ticket to Amsterdam because I'm going there for the weed and that's all I give a shit about. So I get over there and I am like literally, you know, 98 out of 100% freaking out, excited. And I get to this dispensary and I go to the Grasshopper. It's the first one you walk up on. I'm sure everybody that's been to Amsterdam to smoke weed has been to the Grasshopper. And I go in and I got a video camera out. I'm like freaking out, jumping like, oh my gosh. Yeah, I still got the tape, so we should put that on here sometime. And
yeah, we'll get that on the website.
The guy selling the bud is like, hey, motherfucker, you need to chill your ass out. Like, we're gonna have to ask you to leave because I was so excited and freaking out so bad. So then I'm like really nervous that I'm gonna get kicked out and proceed to buy, like, you know, every single. I remember I bought Northern Lights, it was the first thing I bought, and then, you know, two
that was
or three
one of the first
things.
Trains, right? Absolutely, oh, yeah. Everybody heard about that one. Oh, it's Northern Lights,
yeah. And rolled that shit up
and
smoked it. And that was basically, you know, I was already in love. I was already infatuated with the plant. I was the guy in college that had centerfolds of High Times up, you know, and of nuggets instead of hot chicks. Like, I was more into like bud and smoking weed. And I love hot chicks, don't get me wrong, but marijuana has been what did it for me from day one. And it's like, if everybody, you've got a weakness, for me, it's marijuana. And in a good way and a bad way. I have a soft spot in my heart for
it.
Smoke
them out.
And basically, from that moment on, I knew that it was bigger than just buying it and smoking it. That there was something great about this thing. And it, like, there was an industry that I got to walk into a place that sold it for commerce. And, you know, like, and it was creating, like, all the bells started to ring in my head, like, okay, how much money did the airline make for me coming over here? Did every restaurant I eat at, did every single dispensary that I spent, or, you know, coffee shop that I spent all my money on, the pastry shop, Rene's in Amsterdam, anyone that's been there and knows about Rene's, like, I spent thousands of dollars at that place. Like, you know, like, how much trickle up economics again that you can get from this plant and from this experience and from this culture. And
this is all in a flash. This all came to you in a flash. Like,
well, it happened. It started coming to me then. It wasn't a flash. It seems like a flash now. Yeah. You know, and then the rest of that week I was over there. I bought seeds. I went to the cannabis college. I tried to find places to get tours of greenhouses. And
this was 1999.
Yeah, I was 19 years old, or 18. And that's, you know, I thought, hey, you're going to have to move to Amsterdam to get to grow this shit. Sell it.
Yeah, man.
And there is John that owns the Gray Area. He's still over there. He's the only American that owns a coffee shop over in Amsterdam, the Gray Area.
There might be a few now, but.
Yeah, well, this was at that time. And I remember just thinking, like, how do I get to be him? How can I sell pot for a living and make this my passion in my world? And goosebumps, like, you know, totally by a lot of luck and by a lot of hard work, I'm doing it.
Yeah, you are. Oh, you're crushing it, man. You're crushing it. This has been an awesome, awesome conversation. As we've gone through it, I've made notes of other things I've wanted to ask you about or talk about. I feel like we dug deep on a couple things. We got some dirt out. We got some dirt out on the industry. We got some dirt out on growing. We got some dirt out on the money, the politics. Man, I feel like we have covered it all. It's also so long. It's probably going to at least be a 2-part episode.
Yeah.
Part one and two, dos. But it's been great having you on, Matt.
Thank you very much, sir.
I'm sure we're going to have you back. Looking forward to it. And yeah, man, let's go roll some more up.
Word. One quick thing before we go, I will want to just say thank you to you for your contribution, man. Like, I don't know how many people are going to do a good enough job of pointing out that I like to tell people that, you know, Chip made Humboldt, and Chip made the world of marijuana a better place. He was, he's a pioneer in this game, man. He's somebody that I look up to and that, you know, I'm super stoked to know and super stoked to not have to have all the answers, because I got somebody on top of me that can help with the ones that I can't answer. And, you know, just like being a risk taker, being a passionate person, being a lover of the flower and the plant, man, like, thank you for what you do for all of us. Cause my life is 10 times easier and my job is 10 times easier cause I know you and you're my friend. So.
Oh, man, big ups, dude. Thanks, brother.
Yes, sir.
This has been The Real Dirt with Chip Baker. I'd like to thank all of our guests for participating in this fun project. Thanks for sharing your stories and bringing your weed. A huge thanks goes to Cannacraft. They're leading the way in medicinal cannabis throughout California. I'd also like to thank Archive Seeds, preserving genetic history and producing quality seeds in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to give a shout out to Willow, Chris, David, Lisa, Michael, and Hollis. Thanks for making this dirt possible. Stay dirty, my friends.